My castaway this week is a man who's risen to the top of his profession at the age of 33. Such early success is made even more surprising by the fact that the profession he's chosen is a difficult and a serious one, making people laugh. But from the time he came to public attention at the Edinburgh Festival to such popular television programmes as Not the 9 o'clock News and Blackadder, he has managed, with a mixture of satire, irony and expressive facial gestures, to do just that. He is Rowan Atkinson. Rowan, it is a serious business being funny, isn't it?
Yes, for a lot of the time. There are some very amusing moments as well. But it is quite a chore. I find it increasingly easy, to a certain extent, to be relaxed about it.
But do you nevertheless fear that you will wake up one morning and simply not be funny anymore?
Well, five or six years ago, I think I did used to fear that. But increasingly, I don't. Maybe I'm mad. I mean, maybe my optimism is totally unjustified. But increasingly, I suppose I've come to realise that perhaps I can do it and can do things. And I think in terms of the range of work that I feel as though I might be capable of, I feel now that I've only attempted about 40% of what I feel as though I could do. I'm not saying I will ever get the opportunities to explore the other 60%, but that's what I genuinely feel.
What you're saying is you've become a professional.
Maybe I have, yes. I mean, maybe I realise now that I couldn't give it up and become an electrical engineer, and I won't be retiring early.
Will humour be a comfort to you on the island, or do you rarely laugh alone?
I rarely laugh, actually, generally speaking. I think that's true. I laugh at certain specific things and certain performances. People like Barry Humphries in the theatre, but I'm not a laugher, really, generally speaking.
Let's have your first record.
Right, the first record is going back some time. This reminds me of school. At school, I was very sort of electrical engineering-y, and I was one of those little boys who used to carry a screwdriver in the top pocket of his blazer. And I used to run with a friend of mine, Paddy Rickaby, the Film Society at school, and we always used to sort of maintain and look after all the school's film and sound equipment. And I just remember one particular occasion testing the sound system in the Memorial Hall with this record, which was very, very current and very popular at the time, which is Stairway to Heaven by Led Zeppelin.
There's a lady who's sure all that glitters is gold, and she's buying a stairway to heaven. When she gets there, she knows if the doors are all closed, with a word she can get what she can. She wants to be sure, 'cause you know sometimes words have to mean. In a tree by the brook, there's a songbird who sings. Sometimes all of our thoughts are misbehaving.
Stairway to Heaven, Led Zeppelin. Rowan Atkinson, your public school headmaster said you were the most bloody-minded boy he'd ever met. Was that a fair comment, do you think?
It was an extraordinary comment, wasn't it? I mean, when I look back and how basically conventional a bloke I feel as though I am. But for some reason, I had a fairly traumatic time at school, certainly in the last 2 years. I suppose when I was going through my rebellious period.
Were you a clown at school? Did you make your friends laugh all the time?
No, not at all. At least I gave up when I was about 12. I seem to remember when I was 11 and 12, i.e. when I was at prep school, I seem to remember standing up in the changing rooms in front of other boys and doing something peculiar, such as to entertain them. And I remember them laughing a great deal. But then as soon as the adolescent self-consciousness set in, I gave all that up. And I haven't entertained off-screen or off-stage for 20 years, I suppose.
The interesting thing is you don't have a funny face.
No.
I mean, to look at you now... Mm.
That is why I didn't discover it until I was about 21. And it was when I was at Oxford. Someone asked if I'd do something in a one-night review at the Oxford Playhouse, and I had to think of something, and I'd never written anything at that stage, and so I just started sort of improvising in front of a mirror, and suddenly these peculiar creatures started to characterise and to form in front of me.
We used to call it gurning.
Gurning, yes, that's right.
Pulling your face in front.
Well, there are competitions, I think, in the north of England, gurning competitions. Not that I've ever entered one, I haven't.
What about your family? I mean, what was your family background?
It was quite a quiet, middle-class background. My father was a farmer and a businessman in the northeast of England, which is where I was born.
But what does your mother now think of this son she's got, having brought him up to be a proper chap with a good, solid education? Now she's got a chap who makes his money out of making funny faces and saying naughty words on the telly.
Yes. I think she'd prefer not to hear the naughty words, and she'd probably prefer me not to pull too many faces. But she, like a lot of parents, I suppose, was quite concerned about show business as a career and imagined it to be peopled by a lot of, you know, rather plump people with those moustaches that droop round the side of their mouths and huge purple velvet bow ties who hand you grubby fivers at stage doors. And she probably had that image, as indeed I did. And then, of course, since then, I've found that I've worked almost exclusively with Oxbridge graduates, which perhaps pleases her.
Let's have another record.
One of my activities at school, apart from running the Film Society and messing about with screwdrivers, was that I was choir secretary. I was actually in the choir. My voice was never very good, in the same sense that I was also captain of shooting, but I wasn't the best shot in the school. And as choir secretary, at least I did quite a lot of singing, and I grew to know and to love choral music a great deal. And this is The Miserere by Allegri, sung by the King's College Choir from Cambridge. And it is just the most fabulous and moving piece.
Miserere by Allegri, sung by King's College Choir, Cambridge, with Roy Goodman. Well, Rowan, your degree, as you said, is in electrical engineering. Quite a good one, I think, isn't it?
Yes, I worked very hard. As soon as I left school and left all the choir and the shooting behind, that I started to take work more seriously, and I worked very hard. So I was told that I was only 3% off first in my first degree.
Mm. At what point did you know you would never use this degree?
It was about a year later, because I started off at Newcastle University, and then I went on to Oxford to do research, and I suppose it was a year into Oxford that I'd started to take all the review, sketch writing, sketch performing very seriously. And it was in the summer of that year, having met up with a very dear friend of mine, Richard Curtis, who since that time has written or co-written virtually everything I've ever done, and to whom I'm very, very much indebted. And he and I did a review in the summer of 1976, at which I got my first review in the local paper, in the Oxford Mail, and it was a very flattering review indeed, and it was at that point that I decided to at least give it a try. And because I knew that I was going to go to the Edinburgh Festival Fringe with the Oxford University Theatre Group that year, I thought I'd try and get an agent, which is what they always say you should do. So I wrote 8 or 9 letters saying, I think I'm rather good and I'm going to go to the Edinburgh Festival this year. Will you come and see me?
Nothing if not pushy.
Yes, it's the only really pushy thing I think I've ever done. But it paid off to a certain extent because of the 9 letters I wrote, I only got 2 replies. One was from the agent who I eventually went with, Richard Armitage. But thankfully, he was as good a person as I could have found. And I worked with him for about 10 years, right up until his death only about a year and a half ago.
Let's have your third record.
The third record reminds me of university exams, I suppose. When I was at Newcastle, I think I worked really very hard. And before my finals exams at Oxford University, every night, for some reason, I had this kind of tradition that I would play this next record just before I went to bed. Why, I don't know. It was just I just found it inspiring and restful and kind of flushed out of me all the academic thoughts and all the revision that I'd been cramming my head with during the day, so that at least I could sleep. And it's as good a Beatles track to choose as any, and it's Let It Be.
Let It Be from the Beatles. So you went to Edinburgh in 1977. Richard Armitage, the agent, came to see you. What did he say to you could happen? Did he say the world was your oyster?
He was very flattering. So to a certain extent, he certainly insinuated that, but he didn't say it in as many words.
Who were your heroes then? I mean, who did you hold up as being the great comic genii?
Well, I suppose, certainly throughout school and university, Monty Python's Flying Circus was undoubtedly the only programme to watch. And to a certain extent, although they were obviously slightly before my time, Beyond the Fringe, the Peter Cook and Dudley Moore and Alan Bennett and all those folk, they were a tremendous inspiration. Also, at school, to a certain extent, I'd become very interested in a French comedian called Jacques Tati, who was a film comedian who did some very wonderful, very visual films in the 50s and 60s.
What was the first professional engagement that your agent found for you?
I suppose, really, it was a review at the Hampstead Theatre in 1978, a review that was rather pretentiously titled Beyond a Joke. And by 1977, I started to do virtually a one-man show on the Edinburgh Fringe. And that led to this show that I did at the Hampstead Theatre, and that was when they were my first London reviews.
Another record, please.
This reminds me very much of my time at Oxford and of the first steps into review and sketch writing, and is devoted really to the person with whom I've worked most, Richard Curtis. And he was infatuated with two singers at the time. One was Linda Ronstadt, and the other was Paul Simon. So this would certainly remind me of endless hours at the house in Woodstock Road, Oxford, where we used to live and used to work.
I met my old lover on the street last night. She seems so glad to see me. I just smile. And we talked about some old times, and we drank ourselves some beers. Still crazy after all these years. Oh, still crazy. I'm not the kind of man who tends to socialize. I seem to lean on old familiar ways. I ain't no fool for love songs that whisper in my ears. Still crazy after all.
Paul Simon, Still Crazy After All These Years. It's a nostalgic bunch of records, this room.
It is so sad. Why? I don't know. It is difficult, because when you try and think of your eight favourite records, naturally you tend to associate them with items in your times or personalities from your past. And so naturally they're bound to be nostalgic. And if they're nostalgic, then they're bound to be sort of saddening. And it is questionable whether on a desert island you want to depress yourself by playing them.
But are you, I mean, are you quite a melancholy chap?
Not very. I can be, which is why I probably value my friends a great deal.
But the kinds of characters you play are inoffensive people who are rather vulnerable, aren't they?
Yes, they vary, actually. A lot of the characters, well, that I've done from the start, really, have varied between very strict, stentorian, schoolmasterly sort of figures and very, very vulnerable, sad, pathos-orientated figures. And I seem to bounce between the two, and they do represent sort of extremes of performing style.
We saw most of them, I think. You ran the gamut in Not the 9 o'clock News. How did that come out? It's a terribly cumbersome title, isn't it?
It is. It's very difficult to say. But it turned out to be a very good title, or at least the negative aspect of it, the fact that not anything meant that the spin-offs from the show, like Not in Front of the Audience and Not the Royal Wedding, and all those sort of things were rather appropriate for a satirical viewpoint. And it started just because the producers, John Lloyd and Sean Hardy, had seen all four of us, so myself and Mel Smith and Griffiths Jones and Pamela Stevenson, in different places and at different times.
But then it was one of those moments in television, wasn't it, when everything came together?
When it really gelled. Mm. I thought it was great. It was, yes, in the middle of the second series, I think, when we really started to get to grips with what we actually wanted to do. And the great thing about working with other people of very strong and different performing styles is that it inspires you to move into new areas. I had my sort of, you know, little one-man showy area that I felt all I was going to do on Not 9 o'clock News was come in and do a monologue every week and then go out again. And then suddenly working with Mel Smith, or working with Griff, that you were pulled in different directions.
Yeah. Let us have your fifth record.
This is a singer that I discovered relatively late on, when I was starting to live in London at the end of the 70s. And it's Ella Fitzgerald, and I discovered two records of hers, the Cole Porter songbook and the Rodgers and Hart songbook, and I'm afraid it's another very, very sad song, which is, I believe is about a woman who's been hanged, but I'm not sure. It's called Miss Otis Regrets.
Miss Otis Regrets, she's unable to lunch today. Madam, Miss Otis Regrets, she's unable to lunch today. She is sorry to be delayed, but last evening down in Lover's Lane she strayed. Madam, Miss Otis Regrets, she's unable to lunch today. When she woke up and found that her dream of love was gone, madam, she ran to the man who had led her so far astray. And from under her velvet gown, she drew a gun and shot her lover down. Madam, Miss Otis regrets she's unable to lunch today.
Ella Fitzgerald singing Miss Otis Regrets. Rowan, the first Blackadder, I think, was in 1983. He was your own creation, wasn't he? This kind of sex-crazed Elizabethan.
Sex-crazed. Well, of course, initially it wasn't Elizabethan. It was medieval. It was, the first series was set in the 15th century, and it was an idea not of mine alone. It was an idea of myself and Richard Curtis to try and do a situation comedy of some kind in the wake of Not the 9 o'clock News, which we'd stopped in 1982. And at the time, of course, Fawlty Towers was at its height, and everything, and we loved it like everyone else did. It still, in my view, defines situation comedy on television. And it was incredibly difficult trying to think of something that would not appear to be just a rather feeble copy of it, which is why we thought if we set a situation comedy, you know, 5 centuries back, we at least might have a better chance of avoiding direct comparison. The Blackadder, the name, came from nowhere in particular. We were just looking for a sort of slightly dark, slightly Errol Flynn-y sort of name, which wasn't particularly amusing and wasn't, you know, laden with pun.
But quite a lot of comedians use historical settings for their sketches, don't they? I mean, one thinks of Monty Python and the Holy Grail, or Russ Abbott, indeed. I mean, he puts some knickerbockers on and cross garters and makes us laugh. Why do you think that is?
I don't know. I suppose you... Obviously, the costumes are funny to a large extent, and we certainly exploited that more in the first series than in either the second two. We had, you know, absurd codpiece jokes and things, which I'll probably regret when I look back at them in 10 years' time. In fact, I'm beginning to regret them even now. And out of it came a lot of jokes, because it was a time when things were very dangerous, when if someone said, I'm going to kill you, you know, he really meant it, and there's a very good chance that he was just going to stick a sword through you. And therefore, the sort of danger and the awfulness of the times, particularly in the first series, the medieval times, the sordidness and the dirt and the squalor and all that, they do provide a nice, horrible, serious background from which the comedy can stand proud.
Well, now, somebody stuck a sword in you in 1986 when you went to Broadway, and it was the Butcher of Broadway, they called him, didn't they? Frank Rich of the New York Times.
Yes.
Who killed your show overnight, really.
Yes, he did. It was a fascinating time. It really
fascinating.
Well, no, it was. I mean, it was fascinating. It was frustrating, but it was fascinating, and I wouldn't have... I don't regret going, not for one minute. The peculiar thing about Broadway is that it is a very unusual place because of this factor, the New York Times factor, that basically whatever the New York Times says, then that goes in New York.
He accused you of being lavatorial.
Yes.
Which you were.
I mean, only to a certain extent. No review that I got, and Frank Rich wasn't the only person on Broadway who didn't like what we were doing, but there were a couple of others, and generally their standpoint was, you know, good old English lavatorial humour, how bored we are of it. But of course I've had all those reviews endless numbers of times in this country. I mean, folk have always... I mean, the first series of the Blackadder was absolutely slammed for those reasons. Virtually everything I've ever done has been decried in a lot of areas of the press and the media.
But that's the difference, isn't it? That in Britain you can be given time to develop, and people will give you a second or a third chance and wait for something to come through. In the States, it either happens or it don't.
Yes, it does. I mean, the main reason for that, of course, on Broadway is a financial one, because the cost of staying on Broadway is so astronomical that unless you're basically full all the time, you can't afford to stay.
Another record.
Well, this reminds me, I suppose, of a sketch in the one-man show that I first did in the Secret Policeman's Ball in 1979, which was a mime sketch, a piano mime. And although this wasn't the piece that we actually used, I, like a lot of people, learned piano for 2 years at school and have deeply regretted giving it up. Ever since, I would dearly, dearly love to play the piano. I would like to play like anyone who can play Chopin really well.
Chopin's Nocturne in C-sharp minor, opus 27, number 1, played by Vladimir Ashkenazy. Well, Rowan, fame, as you described, came upon you really rather suddenly. A lot has been said about your having had too much too fast. Do you feel that?
Well, I did feel it, in that it's something that I was very worried about at first, that I would just be a flash in the pan and would disappear. But I, to a certain extent, I've come to live with it. It's sometimes extremely difficult if fame gets in the way when things are going wrong. It's always that moment when you've just missed the train and somebody comes up and starts to pester you, or when your car's broken down, or you get to the cash till at the motorway services and you haven't got any money and you've left it in the car. It's all very well saying, well, I'm just a very normal sort of electrical engineering type of bloke from the northeast of England. But of course, I can't be now.
When are you at your happiest?
I'm at my happiest either with my friends or with my girlfriend, or I suppose in terms of singular selfish experiences, I think it's probably driving a very fine car, very fast, with certain music playing on the stereo system. I've started very cautiously to embark on a modest amount of motor racing, and I get a tremendous degree of excitement from that. The challenge of it is very enthralling.
You also collect motor cars, don't you?
Yes, I mean, in no great way. I've sold quite a few recently because I decided that I had too many.
But what have you got?
I've got down to a modest number now. Well, I've got a little Lancia, which I kind of shop around in, which is very interesting. But my main car, I suppose, is an Aston Martin. It's the third Aston Martin that I've had in about 7 years. And it is a tremendous car. But the strange thing is that even though it is a fast car and it is designed to go fast, that is not really where most of the joy of ownership comes from. It is that thing, joy of ownership, which you feel, which I actually feel as much just cleaning the car. Ever since I was 16 or 17, no, ever since I was 12 or 13, I've really enjoyed washing cars for some reason. I enjoy the task of taking something dirty and washing it and working on it and then seeing this immaculate and shining object at the end of the exercise. And it's a very practical and sort of simple satisfaction, but it is very, very real.
Your seventh record, please.
About a year and a half ago, I bought an album by a contemporary rock band called Simply Red. And on it, I discovered this extraordinary version of Cole Porter's Every Time We Say Goodbye, which, for all those who believe that contemporary rock vocalists have not the skill or the emotion wanted to sing like they used to in the old days. I think this is a song and a track which should dispel any of those thoughts.
Mick Tucknell of Simply Red with Cole Porter's Every Time We Say Goodbye. Looking at your heroes, you know, I mean, if you say Peter Sellers, people say Inspector Clouseau. If you say Dudley Moore, they say Dud. If you say John Cleese, they say Basil Fawlty.
Yes.
What do you want them to say when they say Rowan Atkinson? I mean, do you want them to say Blackadder?
Well, for the time being, they tend to say it. So I'm perfectly happy with that. Well, I think, for instance, Peter Sellers did a lot more than just Inspector Clouseau, although, obviously, you're right, that's what he is best remembered for. But he had an extraordinary acting range. But that sort of range is something... I mean, maybe I will do the one character that everyone will remember me for, and maybe, you know, that the Blackadder characters will be the ones that people will remember, and I'll never do anything else that is memorable. But I enjoyed the time at Not the 9 o'clock News because it gives you such... an opportunity to explore a range. I mean, every week you can play five or six different characters and you don't feel remotely typecast and people know you as Rowan Atkinson rather than as Mr. Blackadder. Or...
But I read you want to be a baddie in James Bond.
Yes. Well, I always played very evil people in plays at school for some reason. The first part I ever played at the age of 14 was a fire-raising head waiter in a play called The Fire Raisers by Max Frisch, who invites himself into a man's house and then blows it up. And I also played Mephistopheles in Dr. Faustus and all those sort of, you know, satanic roles.
It's the eyebrows.
It's the eyebrows. Oh, good. That's good. That's good to know. I'll remember that at my next audition. Use the eyebrows. I would love to play a villain in a Bond film, but I find that as I get older, the range of parts I can play becomes broader and becomes easier. I think if you are a character actor, which to a certain extent I hope I am, then of course most character parts are not set in your 20s, they're set in your 40s or in your 50s. And they are the sort of parts that hopefully will become increasingly easy to cast me in.
Your eighth and your final record, Peter.
Well, this is, it's slightly sentimental and it reminds me of my first date with my girlfriend and we went to see Dire Straits at Wembley Arena. And I think Mark Knopfler, yet another Mark, is a tremendously good writer of music. And as my musical director, who writes a lot of music for Blackadder and things, says, Dire Straits and Mark Knopfler, he writes wonderful tunes and then never sings them. He lets his guitar play them and he sort of moans along in the background. And this is an example of it, but he's brilliant.
Thank you.
Lady Writer by Mark Knopfler of Dire Straits. Rowan, I have the impression that you're going to sit on this island, listen to your records, and really get quite miserable.
But assuming that music is one of the best reasons for living, then I don't think it matters really what music you play, as long as you play it. And if it reminds you of your past, even if it's saddening or makes you cry, I think if it just reminds you of your friends, then I think it'll stop you killing yourself.
What will you miss most?
I think I have to say friends. And just leading a normal life. I love shopping, you know, and I love driving, and I love just kind of tootling about. So I'd miss that.
Well, you can take something with you. We're giving you the records. Which one of those, by the way, will you choose if you can only have one?
Dear me, I'm torn between choosing the most cheerful
rather
than the most sad. Where's that? I think it would probably be the last one, the Dire Straits track. But if I had to choose the most inspiring, then it would be the Allegri Miserere. Although it is unfortunately also the most sad. But I'll choose that anyway, the Allegri Miserere.
And as you know, we give you the Bible and we give you the complete works of Shakespeare. What mm-hmm. book are you going to take?
I think I have to take a funny book. In an attempt to offset the sadness that the music will bring me. I'm not very well read at all. I'm a terribly bad reader of books. It's really only on holiday that I get the John le Carré out. And if it's not John le Carré, then it tends to be P.G. Woodhouse, because he makes me laugh more than anyone else in print. And it would probably be the first book that I ever read of his, which I found in the school library at the age of 16, and it was called Uncle Fred in the Springtime.
And your luxury?
This is a very difficult one, but after a lot of heart searching, I've decided to take a car. And it doesn't really matter what sort of car it is, but it should be a nice one, and therefore I think it should be an Aston Martin. And all I want to do to it, really, is clean it. So it can be locked up, and so I can't use it to sleep in it, and no petrol, and we presume no roads to drive it on. But I could build a little bamboo carport. And as long as with the car came a plentiful supply of car wax and a plentiful supply of those little orange dusters with red sewn edges that you find in all good hardware stores, then I would just occasionally clean it and look at it.
You shall have it all. Rowan Atkinson, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you.